Hello. My name is Dipu Maseba, and this is the Commercial Awareness Podcast, episode 66. First, some headlines. First, in a follow-up from episode 65 in the TikTok story, ByteDance has accepted Oracle's offer to partner with TikTok, and the U.S. Treasury has said the deal will be reviewed in due time. More to follow. In law firm news, both Clifford Chance and Slaughter & May have won multi-million pound mandates from the UK government. Clifford Chance will advise the Department for International Trade to negotiate post-Brexit free trade agreements, and Slaughter & May will advise the Department of Transport over a new rail project, and the Department for Digital, Culture, Media, and Sport to revive the film and TV industry disrupted by the pandemic. The Road Haulage Association, a trade association for road transport and freight logistics companies, has warned of a severe disruption to supply chains for the end of the transition period on the 31st of December. In another indication of shifting retail habits, as the High Street announces job cuts, Amazon has said it will be creating 7,000 more jobs in the UK. US tech company Nvidia has acquired UK-based chip designer Arm for $40 billion in the largest deal in the semiconductor industry, with Latham & Watkins advising Nvidia and Morrison Forster advising Arm's previous owner, SoftBank. To sweeten the deal for CMA antitrust concerns, Nvidia has pledged to keep Arm's HQ in the UK and protect jobs. And finally, in a step to reach their target of net zero emissions by 2050, BP, also known as British Petroleum, have purchased an £850 million stake in two US offshore wind projects, forming a strategic partnership with the Norwegian oil company Equinor. HSF has advised BP, and CMS and Bracewell advised Equinor. If you'd like to read more on any of these stories, links as always are in the description. Before we get into the longer reads, if you follow the podcast's Instagram account, you would have seen that the release of the episode was halted in case there would be any further news about TikTok. And there has been news, but everything is still in a state of flux, so we might as well wait to give a full update on the story once there is a little more certainty. What's worth knowing for now is that after Sunday, the 20th of September, TikTok will be removed from all US app stores, meaning no new downloads or updates. Oracle will remain in talks with the administration to establish a plan going forward. We'll see if anything changes next week. This week's format is two longer reads. For the first read, let's talk about PwC, Slater & Gordon, and Watchstone, formerly known as Quindel. This story is a lot. It requires some context, a bit of a recent history lesson, and also what feels like law firm hot goss. However, it also brings with it a follow-up from something we spoke of recently in the Wirecard scandal, and even episode 53 story of MW Solicitors Administration. Enough burying the lead, though. To begin, let's talk about Slater & Gordon. Slater & Gordon is an Australian law firm, and entered the UK market in 2012 through the acquisition of a UK law firm. After acquiring a number of other national firms, it became one of the largest personal injury law firms and one of the largest family law service providers in the UK, along with business legal services in employment and regulatory. However, what's important for this story was the 2015 acquisition of Quindel's Professional Services Division, or PSD for short. You may know the story, you may not, but what's important to note is such an acquisition or expansion is not entirely foreign for a law firm. It's an oft-used phrase throughout this podcast that firms, facing competition amongst themselves and the Big Four and their legal divisions, are innovating to also be so-called one-stop shops for clients. This purchase of Quindel's PSD was done with this intention. Quindel, for its part, was a business that found much of its allure through its own acquisitions. Starting out as just a management company for a golf club, a number of acquisitions later led to it becoming an AIM-listed insurance and tech group with a legal offering. In fact, it too became a one-stop shop for those with insurance claims, and boasted a portfolio of tens of thousands of industrial hearing loss cases, which seemed like a treasure trove at the time for Slater & Gordon and their own personal injury practice. This made Quindel's professional services division quite attractive for acquisition. And so, Slater & Gordon acquired Quindel for £637 million in 2015. However, in the year leading up to that offer and acquisition, PwC was hired by Quindel to look into their finances, and it was concluded that Quindell had, quote, aggressive and unacceptable, end quote, accounting practices, particularly in the PSD. Their accountant had been KPMG at the time. Regardless, the transaction went through, and assumedly, Slater and Gordon did their due diligence and were happy with their target and their warranties, bad press and all. But this transaction soon soured, as no more than 2 months after the sale, new management at Quindell told its investors that historical accounts were misstated, and for example, a year that was previously stated to have been a profit of £80 million was actually a £375 million loss for the part of the business Slater and Gordon had just acquired. This even resulted in a serious fraud office investigation, which is ongoing 5 years later. 18 months after the acquisition, the entire value of Quindell's assets had been written off. Slater and Gordon shareholders filed a class action lawsuit against Slater and Gordon, which was settled. Slater and Gordon sued Quindell, now called Watchstone PLC, for £637 million, the value of the acquisition. Watchstone countersued for £63 million over the deal actually being undervalued because of a disclosure issue. And hours before the trial was about to begin, they settled, Slater and Gordon probably interested in removing the bad press. A law firm in court for any reason other than representing a client is probably a bad look. KPMG was fined £3.2 million and the partner in charge of the relationship with Quindell was fined £84,000 by the Financial Reporting Council. Slater and Gordon UK, as a result of a recapitalization, now exists completely independent from the rest of the Slater and Gordon group that exists elsewhere. We could end the history lesson there, but we may as well address the elephant in the room first. Did Quindell commit fraud? I would like to unequivocally say that I, Tsipiwa Maseba, of the Commercial Awareness Podcast, am not alleging that at all. As the youth would say, I do not want any smoke. The settlement between Watchstone and Slater and Gordon includes Slater and Gordon withdrawing any claims of fraudulent misrepresentation or breach of warranty. Therefore, who am I to say anything different? You may find out more when the Serious Fraud Office completes its investigation. However, before we get into why we're talking about this story today, there is an interesting discussion to be had about how their finances may have been overstated in such a way. And it's to do with something we spoke about in episode 53 when we detailed MW solicitors going into a pre-pack administration. Part of the origin in MW solicitors' financial troubles was a term called lockup. Lockup can be defined as the period between converting work in progress and debtors into cash. Essentially, how long is it until a law firm is paid for the work they are currently doing or have already done? MW solicitors, Slater and Gordon, and Quindell had something in common, and it was personal injury work. Personal injury claims can be very lucrative, but can take a lot of time between the claim and the decision of the case. This makes its lockup significantly longer than other practice areas. The issue was, Quindell would list their work in progress as revenue, and it would be measured as the sought-after award and the likelihood of success. However, with new regulation tightening eligibility of accident compensation, and rising costs because of the difficulty in proving the cause of the once-thought lucrative hearing loss claims, these work in progress revenues rarely became actual cash at the end of lockup, or would significantly differ from the projected fee. I mention that now to merely highlight that though this may have happened in 2015, MW solicitors entered into administration this past year. This means that lockup is still an issue firms are facing, and it is probably an issue that has been exacerbated as a result of the lockdown potentially creating a backlog in cases and hearings. And so as the age-old challenge remains, how do law firms convert works in progress into cash more steadily and sustainably? It's worth brainstorming how you would resolve this issue, no matter the firm or practice area. Great, so we skirted the elephant in the room quite gracefully and made the history lesson worth our time. But next, let's get to why we're talking about it today. So, do you remember when I mentioned PwC and their investigation into Quindell's accounting? And the Watchstone counterclaim of £63 million over disclosure resulting in an undervaluation of the acquisition? Well, Watchstone is now suing PwC for £63 million for breach of contract, breach of fiduciary duty, and committing, quote, unlawful means conspiracy, end quote, against it. This is because Watchstone alleges that during the period in 2015, when PwC was brought on to check the finances of Quindel, once Slater and Gordon had approached Quindel to acquire the PSD, a PwC exec had a, quote, quiet coffee, end quote, with an exec from Greenhill & Co., a financial advising company that happened to be advising Slater and Gordon in the acquisition. During that quiet coffee, Watchstone alleged that the PwC exec shared confidential details about then Quindel's finances, which then allowed Slater and Gordon to pay £63 million less than they should have. Watchstone alleged that they only found out about this meeting through the pre-trial disclosure of documents in the now-settled lawsuit Slater and Gordon brought against them. For their part, PwC have said, quote, we deny these allegations and will vigorously defend this claim. It would be inappropriate to comment further on an ongoing legal matter, end quote. And so, that's where we are. Why does this matter? Well, it involves a law firm, albeit tangentially at this point, but it also includes the Big Four and a breach of fiduciary duty. But first of all, I have to at least acknowledge the audacity Watchstone has presented here, alleging that they should have gotten more from an acquisition that was completely written off less than 2 years later. However, if the allegation is valid, it is quite fair. The disclosure of sensitive information resulting in a slight diminishing of negotiating power for a seller is quite serious, as is an allegation of fiduciary duty breach for one of the Big Four. But it does also make you wonder how often such quiet coffees actually occur in our day-to-days, where people who happen to work in the city talk shop, and whether that ever influences transactions on scales we may not actually be aware of. It then makes you wonder why it doesn't come back to bite them more often. But that's just a side thought of mine. Back to topic, though, this allegation applies even more pressure on the Big Four, considering the recent accounting scandals of NMC Health, Thomas Cook, and Wirecard. Surely this would not help the Big Four situation, especially after the Financial Reporting Council, which is the accounting watchdog, recently lambasted the six largest accounting firms for, quote, unacceptable, end quote, work. However, PwC is part of a cohort of consultancy firms that have recently been paid a total of £100 million in consultation fees by the UK government. And on top of that, in October last year, the FRC reported that the Big Four now audits 100% of the FTSE 100 companies. So, I guess we can all go home? Jokes aside, it ultimately speaks of the oligopoly that exists amongst the Big Four. But this new allegation could be unique because it alleges a breach of confidentiality, which will probably pique the interest of accounting firms and clients more than the usual accounting scandal. Or it might not. That's possible too. Regardless, this new lawsuit reminds us of a number of topics we've previously spoken about. And aside from the new lawsuit, it reminds us of the issues firms face as they expand and function. A buyer will always carry some risk in an acquisition, hence the principle of caveat emptor, let the buyer beware. But a law firm carries more risk than most because a bad acquisition would definitely result in reputational damage, lawsuit or not. For this reason, finding workarounds that benefit both parties in an acquisition, such as specific warranties or lucrative earnout clauses, which are clauses that give the seller money if the target company performs well financially post-completion, could be a solution to prevent situations like this, and could ensure acquisitions are relatively drama-free for firms that have quite a lot to lose. But as it's often a seller's market in scenarios like this, a seller may want more money up front, which once again puts the ball in the buyer's court for extensive due diligence. Further, it reminds us of lockup once again, and the challenges firms of all sizes face when it comes to beginning a matter, the matter being a work in progress, the matter being completed, and the firm receiving the money for the hours billed. All these steps can take a number of years, and there's a balance to be struck in ensuring payment while also maintaining a healthy rapport with clients for future work. And so, history lesson aside, the current lawsuit has reminded us of the challenging Big Four conundrum, lockup, and once again, caveat emptor. And to conclude, once again, unequivocally, no allegations of wrongdoing from me to anyone involved. Just can't say that enough. Credit for this story goes to Kate Bioli, Tabby Kinder, the Financial Reporting Council, the Serious Fraud Office, Richard Ackland, John Hyde, Naomi Rovnek, Ben Marlowe, and Ben Martin. Finally, let's talk about LVMH and Tiffany & Co. This story allows us to take a trip down the podcast memory lane in some respects. The first time we mentioned the story was early December in episode 31. It was a headline that read, LVMH, the luxury house behind Dior and Louis Vuitton, has agreed to acquire U.S. jeweler Tiffany & Co. for $16.6 billion. Skadden are advising LVMH, and Sullivan & Cromwell are advising Tiffany, with Citi, J.P. Morgan, and Goldman Sachs as financial advisors. The acquisition was agreed in November 2019. Simpler times. I say simpler times because a little more than a month later, a disease of unknown origin was discovered and you know the rest. Then in episode 47, we mentioned that the pandemic was changing the landscape in M&A, resulting in a mutual cancellation of a merger between Hexcel and Woodward, two Boeing suppliers, as the pandemic clouded the financial benefits of such a merger. And back then, it would be fair to think that maybe this would just be an aviation issue. The halting of pretty much all international travel would be sure to change how lucrative the entire aviation sector would be. However, in episode 52, we covered two more called-off deals. One between two insurance companies, Covéa and Partnery. In an update to that one, to avoid any litigation, the dissuaded buyer agreed to invest 1.5 billion euros into the target's entities to ensure there'd be no bad blood. The second one was between private equity company Sycamore Partners and Victoria's Secret, where the buying entity Sycamore tried to get out of acquiring a majority stake in their target that they had previously agreed on in February by suing target company Victoria's Secret, alleging that Victoria's Secret improperly managed the business during the pandemic. Victoria's Secret counterclaimed, alleging that Sycamore was only doing this so they could renegotiate the fee. The two parties called a truce, with Sycamore no longer having to acquire the majority stake and not having to pay a termination fee. At the time of the truce, Victoria's Secret's parent company, L Brands, said it was best to move on, quote, rather than engage in costly and distracting litigation to force a partnership with Sycamore, end quote. We followed up on that story in episode 56, as Victoria's Secret's UK arm then had to enter into a light touch administration, which at the time begged the question as to why they didn't actually try to force that partnership. Granted, the UK business had been on a downward trajectory before the pandemic, reporting an operating loss of £170 million last year. Maybe they saw the writing on the wall. Regardless, a current update to that story is, this past week, clothing retailer Next has agreed to purchase a majority stake in Victoria's Secret's UK arm in a joint venture with L Brands, acquiring a majority of Victoria's Secret's UK assets this year, and the digital business next year. So I guess that ended pretty amicably too. But in episode 56, we also mentioned that the LVMH and Tiffany transaction was beginning to sour. In Q1 of 2019, Tiffany had a $125 million profit. Q1 of 2020, after lockdowns and economic downturn, Tiffany suffered a net loss of $65 million. But as the acquisition was agreed upon, LVMH as the buyer would not have many options to bring Tiffany back to the negotiating table to reduce the fee. In episode 56, we detailed that there may have been a silent hope from LVMH that the net losses would result in Tiffany breaching the terms of their debt facilities. Part of the acquisition agreement made such a breach material enough to call off the transaction. That's called a MAC clause. MAC is an acronym for Material Adverse Change. It's pretty much the only clause that gives a buyer the right to terminate a share purchase agreement and requires the target company to have materially and adversely changed. Two high bars. The MAC clause is also interchangeable with the MAE clause, which is an acronym for Material Adverse Effect or Event. And so, it was agreed that Tiffany breaching any debt obligations would be a material and adverse change. However, at that time, Tiffany announced that they had successfully renegotiated their debt covenants with creditors and lenders, with Tiffany CEO Alessandro Bollio saying, quote, I am confident that Tiffany's best days remain ahead of us and I am excited we'll be taking that journey with LVMH by our side, end quote. I interpreted that to mean, quote, we have zero interest in renegotiating, you still have to pay us $16.6 billion, end quote. And so, that's where we were. The agreement had a drop dead date of August 24 this year, which is to mean that if the acquisition didn't close by then, either party could walk away. Such a drop-dead date usually exists so deals don't drag on perpetually. The drop-dead date could be unilaterally extended by 3 months by Tiffany, and so they did, putting the definitive and final drop-dead date at November 24 of this year. And that was pretty much the story until last Tuesday. On the 8th of September, LVMH's legal team wrote a letter to Tiffany, telling their target that on the 31st of August, the French foreign minister wrote to LVMH asking them to delay the completion of the acquisition until the 6th of January to support the French government. What this was in reference to is proposed U.S. tariffs on French goods starting on the 6th of January, in retaliation against a proposed digital services tax in France, a topic we last covered in episode 61. LVH was claiming that they were merely being asked to perform their civic duty. That's why they couldn't purchase Tiffany as they were contractually obliged to. In the letter to LVMH, the French foreign minister said, quote, "I'm sure that you'll understand the need to take part in our country's efforts to defend its national interests," end quote. Quick side note, a lot of business decisions being made for national interests these days. Back to the story. Tiffany obviously did not like this news, and so on the 9th of September, Tiffany filed a lawsuit against LVMH, seeking an order from the Delaware Chancery Court requiring LVMH to complete the acquisition before the final drop-dead date. Tiffany alleged that, quote, "LVMH's recent actions shed light on the true motives behind LVMH's contrived delays and missed deadlines," end quote, and that it has, for one, breached its requirement in the merger agreement to seek antitrust approval, quote, "as promptly as practicable," end quote. Instead, they have dragged out antitrust checks in different countries after previously stating that the deal has no antitrust risk. And according to Tiffany, more than 9 months after the agreement, quote, "have yet even to file its formal request for antitrust approvals in the European Union and Taiwan, and the transaction has yet to receive clearance in both Japan and Mexico as a result of LVMH's inexcusable delay in responding to the reviewing authorities' requests for information in those countries," end quote. Second, Tiffany alleges that LVMH is using the pandemic's industry-wide effects as a material adverse effect worthy of terminating the agreement, as we kind of alluded to what they were hoping for in episode 56. Tiffany alleged that LVMH have tried to use the pandemic as a reason why Tiffany could not extend the drop-dead date. Tiffany has retorted, stating that material adverse changes need to be specific to Tiffany, and even then, quote, "updated forecasts provided by Tiffany to LVMH in August 2020 at LVMH's insistence project that Tiffany's earnings for the fourth quarter of 2020 will be greater than the same period in 2019, demonstrating a rapid return to, and surpassing of, Tiffany's pre-pandemic performance," end quote. And even then, if Tiffany's financial results did not meet financial projections, it was agreed upon that such a result would not amount to a material adverse change. Tiffany concluded, quote, "it is now unmistakably clear that LVMH has been running out the clock for the last 5 months in an effort to get to the initial August 24, 2020 drop-dead date without the necessary antitrust clearances so that LVMH could manufacture, or at least threaten Tiffany with, a non-existent right to terminate or refuse to extend the merger agreement, all part of an entirely improper effort to strong-arm Tiffany into agreeing to reduce the merger price. Such a strategy should not be countenanced," end quote. They seek specific performance from the court, which would be requiring LVMH to go through with the merger, and a declaration that there has been no MAC, or MAE, M-A-E, for a material adverse effect, or any other ground for LVMH to break the agreement. The next day, LVMH announced an intention to countersue, alleging that Tiffany improperly managed the business during the pandemic. We've heard that before. In a press release titled, quote, "LVMH intends to file a lawsuit against Tiffany as a result of crisis management," end quote, LVMH expresses surprise at the lawsuit, calls it defamatory and unfounded, and says, quote, "LVMH will defend itself vigorously," end quote. The press release even says that the delay in filing for antitrust approval in the EU has always been planned, and that will happen in the coming days. Quote, "it is simply the result of the planning fixed by the European Commission, about which Tiffany is completely aware," end quote. Quick comment about that, though. That would be weird considering it's long after the initial drop-dead date, but we move. Finally, LVMH alleges that this period is impacted by a material adverse effect, assumedly the pandemic, and that Tiffany, quote, "did not follow an ordinary course of business," end quote, during it, because they distributed dividends to shareholders as it was loss-making. And so, what's next? On the 21st of September, a Delaware judge will decide whether the case should be expedited or instead be scheduled for some time in 2021. But other than that, now we wait. Okay, take a breath. let's talk about it. I know the title of the episode will merely say LVMH Tiffany lawsuit, but I feel like this read has been so much more than that. It's been a whole timeline of a number of deals we've covered in the past with a where are they now tacked on. And we've even revisited the digital services tax and how it's now being used as a reason to walk away from a transaction or reduce the agreed fee, which on its own shows the TikTok story in another light as other countries seemingly adopt this business in light of national interests approach across the board. It's all like a commercial awareness podcast greatest hits. But in the midst of these updates, whether it's Covea and Partnery and Sycamore and L Brands, those have ended relatively amicably. Covea and Partnery maintain a healthy relationship. Victoria's Secret finally found a majority stake buyer. But this one, so far, seems like it might not end so amicably. L Brands as seller in the Sycamore dispute seemed pretty ready to just let it go when litigation came knocking, even though they arguably had the leverage. Sycamore had agreed to buy the stake in the midst of the pandemic, and for that reason alone, it's not like they could argue that the pandemic materially and adversely affected the transaction. And I won't try to predict the psychology behind L Brands' concession, as they kind of told us in the statement. They didn't want to engage in costly litigation to force a partnership. One, litigation is expensive, and two, they didn't want to force a relationship with an entity that no longer wanted to be in one. And three, maybe their lawyers told them a light touch administration was probably a better route anyway. A light touch administration allows the directors to stay in power, but also provides the company with a moratorium to prevent any creditor action. It buys time. And the outcome was pretty successful, considering the UK arm of Victoria's Secret had been loss-making anyway, to have found an enthusiastic majority buyer in Next, subject to regulatory approval, must be seen as a pretty big win. However, this is very different. It seems that LVMH have tried every play in the book to renegotiate the fee. Waiting for Tiffany to breach a debt covenant. Waiting until the very last minute to seek antitrust approval. Waiting for the drop-dead date to pass. And now, using a letter from the French government's foreign minister to justify letting the transaction die. Even now alleging, as Sycamore alleged against L Brands, that the target was improperly managed during the pandemic. And it seems that Tiffany will fight tooth and nail to prevent LVMH from pulling out of the transaction. And as they should, to be fair. You can understand both parties' perspectives. LVMH had been a long-term admirer of Tiffany, then the pandemic happened. It seems they still want to acquire Tiffany, but just at a price that reflects the hit the luxury retail sector took during the pandemic. Even Tiffany see all of this as an attempt at strong-arming so the price can be reduced. And as for Tiffany, you can see why they'd have no interest in reducing the price. Speaking candidly, why in the world would they want to? You successfully negotiated the largest ever deal in the luxury sector after rebuffing LVMH a number of times. This transaction is a reminder of how it works in a seller's market. In fact, if Tiffany's allegations are true in their suit in Delaware, LVMH accepted a fair number of terms in the merger agreement that make this case rather open and shut. A hell or high water clause, meaning LVMH take all antitrust risk and will essentially do whatever it takes to get antitrust approval. And even if that doesn't mean they must seek antitrust approval promptly, they then agree to seek antitrust approval, quote, as promptly as practicable, end quote. And on top of that, they agree to a material adverse effect clause that, according to Tiffany, explicitly carves out events that have industry-wide impact, including, quote, general economic or political conditions, end quote, unless it materially disproportionately affected Tiffany compared to those in Tiffany's industry. And it appears, if Tiffany expects to bounce back and outperform last year's Q4 this year, and have sent those figures to LVMH, and LVMH have not contested those figures, it appears there is no material disproportionate effect to Tiffany's business to contest, dividend or not, Q1 net loss or not. This whole lawsuit is like Tiffany asking LVMH, "This you?" Making reference to all the stringent and oddly specific clauses LVMH agreed to previously and are now trying to get out of. MAC or MAY clauses are rarely successfully used in court, so we'll see, but it's not looking great for LVMH. MAC clauses are hard to use, and you'd assume they're even harder to use if the clause you agreed to specifically carves out industry-wide events you are trying to claim as the cause. But ultimately, it's up to the court, and the first step will be on Monday when the court decides whether the case should be expedited. The remedies can include damages, all the way to the specific performance of requiring LVMH to go through with the transaction. But this whole saga shows the potentially ugly side to the M&A transaction over a pandemic. When the economic situation turns sour, so can a completely positive transaction. And if cooler heads don't prevail, it could definitely escalate. I think neither party want this to result in an outcome where neither of them are happy. But you can see why the buyer has been trying to find relatively lawful ways to get the seller back to the negotiating table, and you can also see why the seller could get frustrated by all of this, up to the point of suing the buyer to stick to its promises. Ultimately, it's possible that after all the huffing and puffing, this could even settle in the next week as well, similar to Sycamore and L Brands. Actually, Bloomberg reports that yesterday, LVMH finally submitted the transaction to the European Commission for Antitrust Review, quote, as it has always stated it would do, end quote. Tiffany responded to the filing by saying, quote, the speed with which LVMH acted after Tiffany filed its complaint in Delaware only underscores LVMH's delays and lack of compliance with the merger agreement over the prior months, end quote. No love lost. Whichever way it goes, this saga makes for interesting reading and will either become the largest deal in the luxury sector or a landmark model for how to renegotiate a previously agreed M&A transaction. It could also make buyer companies a little more reluctant to go too far in a merger agreement to ensure completion, as this shows it may come back to bite you if and when a generation-defining pandemic rolls along. And I say that partly in jest, but more than anything, this entire period has shown that a number of clauses in all kinds of agreements can't be taken for granted anymore, and this will probably inspire a new culture of document drafting. Credit for this story goes to LVMH, the Delaware Chancery Court, Kim Basin, Jeff Feely, Leila Aboud, Arash Masoudi, James Fontanella Khan, and Hortensa Aliage. This has been the Commercial Awareness Podcast. Please be sure to follow, subscribe, and rate the podcast on your listening platform. It goes a long way. Also, recommend it to a friend. If you need to contact me, the podcast email address is on the first line of the episode description, and the podcast Instagram page is at ComAwarePod, that is ComAwarePod, if you prefer to contact me there or just want to follow the podcast there for any updates. The podcast Instagram page is also a way to interact with the podcast where you can participate in polls to reflect on past episodes and suggest topics for future episodes. Other than that, thank you for listening, and you'll hear from me next week.